Živjo, dobrodošli in dobrodošli. Z vami sva
Dunja
in Maruša in vam voščiva srečno v novem letu.
Poslušate podcast Temna stran Lune. V njem najdete zanimive goste in gostje, novice, opazovanja in še marsikaj.
Predvsem pa skušava z njim osvetliti temne oziroma manj znane strani astronomije.
Najprej hvala vsem, ki ste naju in naju še boste podprli pri ustvarjanju podcasta. Kavo oziroma simbolično kavo nama lahko ponudite na spletni strani Ko-fi in ta stran je ko-fi.com/temna stran lune. Maruša, Anchor, veš, ki je platforma, ki naj gosti oziroma gosti posnetke najenega podcasta, nama po novem omogoča, da postaviva vprašanja poslušalcem in poslušalkam.
Ova, res, to je pa res super.
Ja, veš, zadnjič sem poskusila postaviti nekaj vprašanj in sem odkrila, da večina, vsaj tistih, ki so na to vprašanje odgovorili, posluša podcast doma ali pa med vožnjo. Ne poslušajo pa jih običajno med rekreacijo ali pa na delu, kar seveda mogoče ni najbolj primerno. Nekaj poslušalcev pa nama je tudi dalo še nekaj dobrih idej za naslednje epizode, tako da res najlepša hvala, se bova skušali tudi potruditi za naslednje epizode.
Tokrat sva se v pulzarjih, pravzaprav o astrofiziki visokih energij in o divjem ali silovitem vesolju pogovarjali z astrofizičarko, profesorico Gabrielo Zaharias z Univerze v Novi Gorici.
Our first guest of this year is Professor Gabriela Zaharias from the University of Nova Gorica. Gabriela, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Gabriela, you were born and studied also in Serbia, and then your path took you around the world. Where have you been and how did your interest in science and astrophysics evolve along the way?
Good question. Right. So yes, indeed, I studied in Serbia. I was born there. Somehow I decided to study physics. In Serbia, we have this very cool center, you know, for high school students when they can do science in summer. It's called Petica Science Center. But anyway, that was an opportunity sort of to try to be a scientist also as a high school student. And then sort of I got hooked. So after that, yes, I got a PhD at New York University, and there I was doing a bit more theoretical things, always related a little bit in the field of dark matter that we will touch upon maybe later, but from a more theoretical perspective. After that, we moved to Chicago, and I was working in the Fermilab and Argo National Lab, and there were very strong groups working in dark matter with gamma rays. And this is where I sort of started working in this high-energy astrophysics more and dark matter searches from high-energy astrophysics point of view. And that was just years just before this Fermi satellite that we will also talk about was launched. And so sort of that was really the time when sort of gamma ray astrophysics was supposed to take a big leap. And again, I got hooked to that. After that, I worked in Stockholm and in Paris. And in Trieste, and I'm here in the University of Nova Gorica. But since that time, I'm sort of following this gamma ray, high energy astrophysics line of research.
So your field of research is astrophysics of high energies. So how would you describe this? What is this?
So, right, so I work, as I was mentioning now a few times, with this gamma ray astrophysics. So gamma rays are sort of electromagnetic radiation, like visible light is, but radiation of much higher energy than visible light. So this is really the high energy spectrum of electromagnetic radiation that is called gamma rays. And so what that means in practice is that the processes that emit these very high energy gamma energy photons that are gamma rays are very energetic. That means that you're usually talking about quite violent events in the universe, their sort of particle physics nature, becomes relevant, where you really have particles colliding or unusual states of matter and things like that that you're studying. So maybe I would stop here with this general definition of kinetic astrophysics, but then I think we'll get more in detail as we move with the podcast.
So you mentioned the Fermi telescope, that it's one of the elder of the space telescopes that is observing in the high energy universe, or the violent universe, as you told us now. So how large is the international collaboration you are part of, and on what principle is the Fermi telescope based on? So how is this kind of telescope working?
Okay, good, interesting. So right, so for me, in fact, it's elder. It was launched in 2008. So quite a bit of years ago. And it is a satellite, sort of 1 meter cube size. It's not enormous, but its technology, like how it works, it's sometimes they dub it like particle physics experiment in space. So it's a little particle physics experiments, like would be some small CERN-like thing, but launch in space, so much simplified, but still it allowed to basically capture these gamma rays and to determine their direction from where they came from, to determine their energy with much better precision than what was ever possible before. And so it is, in technology space, it was quite revolutionary at that time, and indeed it made many successful discoveries. So it was really a big step forward. Collaboration, I'm not sure about exact numbers, but it's not enormous. It's maybe 200-300 people, from what I know, counting scientists. It's also a bit special, for that time, because it was one of the rare high-energy astrophysics, or in general experiments, that made its data public. So it was not before the practice to open up your data and make it public for everybody to analyze. And for me, collaboration, that was heavily funded by NASA and DOE in the US, and then by many countries in Europe and Japan, made this decision to venture and to make data public, which was also one of the very nice things, and it also contributed to the success of Fermi.
In 2019, you and your collaborator, Professor Tanya Petrushevska, were awarded with Jabolko na Udiha. That's the distinction that was awarded by the former president of Slovenia. And the observations of the Fermi telescope that you just described were very important to trace the extragalactic background light. And I wonder, could you please describe and explain what is this phenomenon and why is it important?
Right, so that was one of the sort of discoveries, if you wish, of Fermi. So Fermi, over these more than 15 years, had many of such contributions. So that one is very nice in a sense that Fermi satellite observes, as I was saying, sources that have very energetic sources that have some violent processes happening in them. And one of the classes of such sources are active galactic nuclei, meaning these are the galaxies that have a super very active supermassive black holes in their centers. And they have jets, and they emit very energetic particles, and then we observe gamma ray from those directions. Fermi observed at this point around 3,000 of such AGNs, which is, again, big leap forward with respect to what was previously known. And so what this analysis did was to consider a large number of these AGNs, active galactic nuclei, or particularly energetic kind called blazars, to look at gamma ray emission emitted from them, and then to study the following effect. Okay, so what happens when extremely high energy gamma rays comes from us from huge distances, megaparsecs or so. What happens, so megaparsec, again, I should probably put it in perspective, but, you know, from different galaxies, from really passes huge chunks of the universe coming to us, such photons, such very energetic photons, scatter of basically starlight, scatter of low energy photons that fill in the universe and lose energy. They produce other particles and basically got absorbed. Okay. And what did scientists realize is that basically by observing these gamma rays from these very far sources and observing how they get absorbed, we can basically learn how much starlight, how much low energy photon is there, photons are there. And by learning that, we can sort of gauge how many stars were there in the universe as we go back in time. So basically, so again, here is another new fact that I put in play, because as gamma rays come from us, from these far away active galactic nuclei, those active galactic nuclei are far from us in distance, but given that that light travels with finite speed, they were also emitted early in time. So basically by seeing gamma rays from these faraway objects and how they are absorbed coming to us, we can learn how much starlight is around, you know, our solar system and going farther in the universe and back in time. And so basically we use this measurement and sort of we're able to map how star formation rate, how the production of star to the history of the universe was happening, and realizing, for example, that around 10 billion years ago after the Big Bang, there was a peak in star formation, say, and things like that. So basically it's an indirect observation, but it tells us how the star formation was happening throughout the history.
That's one really, really interesting result. And also recently the same collaboration discovered a large number of gamma pulsars. And I believe that our listeners already heard about pulsars. And they imagine probably some exotic astrophysical objects. Can you tell us what is a pulsar and when was the first pulsar discovered, what it's made of, and and so on and so forth? And why are these results so important?
Right. So another, exactly, is another cool thing that Fermi discovered in the sky was that the gamma ray sky was full basically of pulsars. So first let's start, as you said, like what are the pulsars? Mm-hmm. So pulsars are very particular objects. They are kind of neutron stars. Okay, so let's start with what neutron star is. So what happens when a very, very massive massive star arrives to the end of its life. So as you know, stars are kept alive by fusion. So stars burn elements, produce energy, and that halts the gravitational collapse that would then that would otherwise crunch the star. So at some point it runs out of fuel. It cannot halt gravitational collapse anymore. When gravitational collapse happens with very massive stars, it basically contracts the star fully to a so-called neutron star, which means that it basically crunches all matter, crunches atoms, and pushes basically protons into electrons, forming another kind of particles, which are neutrons. Neutrons and their own pressure basically manage to halt the gravity. So basically, these stars are very particular because they end up being extremely dense, extremely small. Basically, they're maybe 10 kilometers in diameter. They have extremely dense material, basically pure neutron soup that they're made of. And another thing happens when this collapse of neutron star or massive star occurs is that as you know, this is a standard image that you get in your physics course, that when ballerina sort of rotates with hands open, it rotates slowly, but then when she closes her hands, rotation becomes faster because she's just smaller. Her radial distribution along the axis is smaller. So what happens with pulsars, with neutron stars, is that they're as a big star, they're rotating with some speed, but when the star collapses, when star collapses, it starts to rotate very quickly. And so it rotates basically once every second, say more or less, which is also an amazing number, like a star that rotates around its axis for once a second, which is also amazing concept. So bottom line, so these very fastly rotating neutron stars are become pulsars because as the star rotates very quickly, in a similar way, as its speed increases, also its magnetic field increases, and that all again creates these conditions for violent conditions. And so, in those on the surface of these pulsars, magnetic and electric fields are so strong that they basically strip electrons from the surface. Particles. As they leave pulsar, they emit various photons, various electromagnetic radiation, among them also gamma rays. And so basically pulsars are these sources that rotate very fastly, emit radiation along its magnetic field lines, and basically act like lighthouses. So they swipe the universe with this beam of radiation. And when Earth is such a position that it intersects this beam, we basically see pulses. As pulsar rotates around, it just flashes on Earth once every second, say. And such sources are then called pulsars. They were discovered in the 60s. It's another, among others, also a female scientist, Jocelyn Bell, is credited with this discovery. Basically, it happened in radio wavelength. So radio are photons of lower energies. But she was studying with her collaborators the sky in radio, and then they noticed these weird pulsating objects. That initially, there was also postulated this could be, extraterrestrial life or something, because, it was very weird that you find something pulsating with 1 second cadence. But then after a while, they realized that phenomena is related to neutron stars and basically called these pulsating stars called pulsars.
So you mentioned that pulsars are distributed all over the sky, but I wonder what's their actual distribution? And I think when we mention pulsars, we all know Crab Nebula Pulsar, the most famous one. And I wonder, is this the closest one to the Earth, or is it some other pulsar, and how far away is it?
Good. So good. So for distribution of pulsars. So pulsars, as we were saying before, they're happen at the end stage of a star life. So basically, as stars are pulsar distribution follows that of stars. So pulsars are found in the galactic plane, in these arms of the galactic plane that our galaxy has. We did not talk much about kinds of pulsars that we have. And this is maybe important to mention now because as the star has the life cycle that for some kind of stars ends with neutron stars and pulsars, also pulsars have their own evolution and their own sort of life cycle. So what happens with pulsars is that So when they're born, they're, you know, very young, they're called young pulsars, and they're rotating very fastly, quickly. But as they age, they emit energy, they start rotating slower and slower. Okay, so they become middle-aged pulsars, so-called, and then at some point they rotate so slowly that their emission is not anymore detected as pulsars. So they sort of die out as pulsars. But what can also happen after this long life, you know, after hundreds of millions of years, up to, you know, even billion years, is that some of these pulsars, if they're born in a binary system, if they have a companion star, they can start accreting matter from this companion star, that, and then this matter that falls on them can make them rotate again faster. This is always this conservation of angular momentum that we discussed with Ballerina, but it's also, again, can be at play here, and can basically, one pulsar that is rotating slower, can be spun up again. And those are that kind is called millisecond pulsars, because once when they respawn, they typically respawn so quickly that they rotate once every millisecond, actually, 1,000 times quicker than a usual pulsar would. So why I'm mentioning this? I'm mentioning this because these millisecond pulsars are much older than the normal pulsars. So they're really, really very old. And another interesting thing about pulsars is that when they're created, because they're created in explosions of stars, usually they have some kick velocity. They have some, you know, velocity that they get at birth in this explosion of a previous star. And so what we can notice now in the sky, that these millisecond pulsars, because they're so old, they're not distributed only in galactic plane like normal pulsars are, but these millisecond pulsars are higher, go higher up and below, above and below the plane. So they actually have a different distribution, but this is just due to the fact that they're so much older, which is also, I think, a neat fact that you sort of, you see, you know, how that they moved over the long times. As far as goes the pulsars around the Earth, this is also interesting. So there is the Crab pulsar, you're right, the most famous pulsar of them all. That one is a bit farther from Earth. The closest pulsar to Earth is, so I do not know the name exactly, it's a set of numbers, it doesn't have a neat name, but it is around 80 parsecs from Earth.
Oh, so close.
So parsec, right, parsec is this like distance between, you know, sort of the sun and the closest star. So this would be like 80 times that. So it is quite in our neighborhood. It's quite close. But it's very old. I think it's, yeah, hundreds of million years old, that one. So it's a quiet pulsar. Another pulsar that is famous as well, it's Geminga pulsar. It's like almost as famous as Crab. That one has been known for a long time. It's very visible. It's 300,000 years old. So old, but not horribly old for astronomical standards. And that one is 200 parsecs away. So we do have a healthy population of neighboring pulsars. Again, not really very close, but still in our neighborhood.
Still quite close. What about their ages? You said that a few hundred million years is already old. What's the typical age, or what's young as well?
So Geminga, say, is 300,000 years. I mean, okay, any age, you know, like they can be born with any age, but yeah, so this sort of middle age would be 300,000, and then millisecond, you know, after they die, and then millisecond pulsars can be really sort of nearing up a billion years old, like really as old as the galaxy, or, you know, almost. So yeah, they do span, you know, a large, you know, span of ages.
Let's imagine then we can travel and visit a nearby pulsar. So what it would look like, and would such a visit be dangerous maybe for our life? So we have to be extra careful. What should we expect in the vicinity of those pulsars?
Yeah, so this is also a very nice question. So I think, yeah, because these neutron stars basically are so particular. So I think a visit to the neutron star would be even more particular than a visit to the sun surface, like a visit to a normal star surface. So one thing is, of course, that gravitational pull would be much, much stronger there, because it is already a star, so it's much more massive, you know, than the Earth, but then also its radius is so much smaller. So basically, I believe gravity, and we know that gravity is so strong in neutron stars, because gravity is so strong that it basically crashed matter and made a neutron soup. So I think this is also what would be our destiny, probably, at the surface of a neutron star. And then also there are some, gravitational time dilation, some weird, GR effects that could happen there in such strong gravitational fields. But yeah, I don't think that we would live to tell. Mm-hmm. And then there's also this very quick rotation that on top of everything. So yeah, it would really be a very particular journey.
So your discovery with Fermi was gamma pulsars, and I'm not sure, is this a particular type of pulsars, or is it called gamma because of gamma rays? Or, well, my question is, what are types of gamma of pulsars? Because, well, you mentioned millisecond pulsars, but
okay, so good. Yes, this is something I actually did not get into, and so it should be said exactly, because so why gamma ray pulsars are particular? So because I did mention before that pulsars were discovered in radio band, okay? So they were discovered in much lower energy, with much lower energy photons. And this is actually where most of the pulsars emit. So we currently know about 3,000 pulsars emitting in radio. So it was known from the 60s, basically, steadily people were discovering more pulsars. It was sort of known that pulsars emit in radio wavelengths. But the fact that they emit in radio wavelengths, that means that there are electrons, that I was mentioning before, that these particles, electrons, accelerating the pulsar and emitting radio in strong magnetic fields. But usually when you have electrons, these very energetic electrons, those electrons are also expected to emit gamma rays, very energetic photons, okay? And so people from the beginning wondered, is it... If there are pulsars in radio, will there be pulsars in gamma rays? Okay, so it was not really, it was expected, but it was harder to confirm, it was harder to detect those. And before the Fermi was launched, only a handful of pulsars, maybe around 10, were known. So we knew that they can emit in gamma rays, but it was not clear, is it very particular, just some, or is it normal? This electron population and conditions in the pulsar such that they often or usually emit in gamma rays. And this is why this catalog is interesting, because so over the age of Fermi, then we started discovering more and more gamma ray pulsars. Now finally with this catalog, we are at 300 pulsars. So this is still much less than 3,000 that we know in radio, but this is a big number, and it's basically telling us that emission gamma rays is typical of pulsars as well. So that most of them have it. So gamma ray experiments have some sort of issue. I mean, they're maybe less sensitive, or they have bigger worse angle resolution. So it's harder to detect, sort of pulsars with gamma rays. But the fact that there are so many basically is telling us that pulsars are also gamma ray sources. And in fact, one of the dominant gamma ray sources in our galaxy. And then we can go into kinds of pulsars independent on which wavelength they meet. And there we have these young pulsars, middle-aged pulsars, millisecond pulsars, and little variety and subclasses. Again, this is another thing that is important in this catalog. It has 300 sources because we started to realize that there are also little subcategories between these main categories, young, middle-aged, millisecond. There are some spider called pulsars, and I wouldn't go much in detail, but we're starting now with this large number of sources to learn new and surprising things about pulsars.
And these sources are all inside our galaxy, or not?
Yes. There was a pulsar also detected in a Large Magellanic Cloud, but the large majority of these are in our galaxy, and in fact these are the most numerous type of galactic sources, actually, in Fermi data.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds very mysterious, these spider pulsars.
Yeah, these are also systems like similar to millisecond pulsars, in the sense the pulsars in which pulsar is feeding off a companion star. And then this kind of, you know, interaction causes various effects. In a sense, like, for example, in transitional pulsars, this accretion disk for a star can, for periods of time, completely overrun the pulsar emission. So you do not see it because it's enshrouded in material from companion star and things like that. In some pulsars, we also see some glitches in gamma ray emission. These are like some sort of solar quakes, like some earthquakes on a star. And right, so again, by having so many, a large number of sources, you start to notice details that maybe you wouldn't. But, yeah.
What is an earthquake on a neutron star?
So this is very mysterious in a sense. I don't think that this is very well understood because, again, the neutron stars are made of neutrons. This is all kind of matter, state of matter that we do not know much about. And so it's postulated that glitches probably might have something to do with reorganization on a stellar surface, but it's not, I mean, it's to be understood, let's say.
So we know that pulsars are spinning very fast and they're like lighthouses. So we detect this in a very regular
intervals,
yes. And the question is, yeah, could they be used as clocks?
Right, no, exactly. So pulsars are amazing clocks, and so they can be used. And in fact, a very cool way, so this is not something I work on, but what scientists understood, is that they're using basically these so-called pulsar timing arrays, like array of pulsars in our galaxy, and the timings of their, you know, lighthouse emissions, of their pulsations, to basically test, to look if gravitational waves, maybe are passing through the galaxy. Okay, so again, this is many concepts that I'm throwing just here, but the listeners probably know that there is such thing as gravitational waves, which are sort of stretches of space-time, and that they're produced, for example, when black holes collide, and there was lots of discoveries, and probably you also covered it in your podcast before. And so at this moment, we are measuring these gravitational waves on Earth with experiments that have very long arms. So basically you're trying to see on kilometers scales, like if space is stretched or not. Okay, but with pulsars we basically can increase the length of these arms tremendously. We can basically use all the galaxy and pulsations from different parts of galaxy as the arms of our experiment, and then if gravitational waves pass and distort the space-time at the scales of our galaxy, we can detect due to the difference in arrival of pulsations from pulsars to us. And so, okay, this is a super cool idea. It would probe completely different, you know, events. So far we detected coalescence of sort of stellar mass black holes. With these pulsar timing arrays, we could detect supermassive black holes, you know, collisions and things like that. So yeah, pulsars have many, many faces and many usages. So this is one other cool usage of pulsars.
Going from pulsars to another matter, so the dark matter, we have a guest in our last episode, that was Tadeja Veršić, and she is researching the distribution of dark matter in galaxies. But this is also a topic of your research, as you said before, and you approach it from another point of view, more from the perspective of the particles and their interaction. So we wonder, what is the current state of research in this area, and what are the promising candidates for dark matter particles?
Oh, yes, so this is all other bag of worms, but indeed. So also in the universe, together with this matter that we can see, you know, like pulsars, this active galactic nuclei, we also know gravitationally that there is another glue that gravitationally holds up galaxies, which is called at the moment dark matter, because we do not, you know, yet know what it is, and it does not emit light on itself. So this there is some mysterious fluid that exists in the galaxy that we do not know much about. So, and you're right, scientists can study various things. We can study how this dark matter is distributed, because, you know, through gravity, we can try to learn, you know, where it is. And then if you want, you can use gamma rays, as we use now for pulsars, to try to see, maybe to look in places that you know where dark matter is, where there is lots of dark matter, to see if maybe this dark matter interacts somehow with itself or with other particles, and maybe in those interactions produces gamma rays, produces these very energetic photons, and then try to, you know, by detecting gamma rays, you can try to see if maybe some of those came from dark matter. And so this is hard, of course, I mean, because you have all this amazing astrophysics to understand. And then on top of that, to look for dark matter, but it's also extremely exciting. In particular, pulsars are also relevant in this story, in the search for dark matter, because it turns out that pulsars, that the way pulsars emit, like not really their past emission, but sort of the spectra of this, if you wish, of their emission, is very similar actually to the emission that you would expect from a class of very popular dark matter models. So if you search for dark matter, then pulsars are actually a bad news, because they look quite emission from them, from the population of many, many pulsars in the galaxy, can look a lot like that of dark matter. Those can be confused, and so you have to be very careful, you know, to understand how pulsars emit, how they're distributed, and then to compare to dark matter searches. So what is the status? So there are many dark matter models, different classes. A number of them also should emit in gamma rays or could emit in gamma rays. And so at the moment, we're working hard. We have all these cool experiments, astrophysical experiments that we can use to look for the signals. We did not find them yet. The search is, you know, always getting better. And I don't know what more I can say here. Like, it's exciting. And then, at some point it will be done. it's just not yet there.
What is magnetar?
The magnetars. So, right, the magnetars are also in part of neutron star family, you know? They're similar to pulsars, and in a It's a particular kind of neutron star, or if you wish, pulsar, but not really. So they rotate, but rotate slower than pulsars, and they have strong magnetic fields, and much stronger than the pulsars would have. Okay, so they're a bit weird in this sort of family of neutron stars, basically. Because they have such strong magnetic fields, the sort of emission that you detect from them, they have the bursts, basically, of energy, of gamma rays, if you wish, bursts, and sometimes giant flares. And we believe that those happen because these magnetic field lines sometimes get reconnected or, realigned in some way that exists, that results in a much stronger emission of particles and then this sort of abrupt, stronger emission of flares. So they're very related to, you know, the pulsars that you were studying, but they're even, maybe, if you wish, weirder animal, even stranger objects, and rarer as well.
How do they form? What's the difference in formation between magnetars and pulsars?
So I also don't think that this is much understood. I mean, there are some ideas how magnetic fields got stronger in those systems. I think they believe there's some sort of dynamo mechanism at play in their cores that is making these very strong magnetic fields. But yes, I think maybe there are like 30 objects known at the moment. So I don't think that, you know, that we know horribly much at the moment. But yes, again, by discovering more and more of these objects, I think we will learn more. So just the last question would be, what are you working on now? And if you can, if you can tell us what are you interested in?
Yes. So at the moment I'm working always with gamma rays, mostly, but now in preparation for the next generation gamma ray observatory that is called Cherenkov Telescope Array. So that will not be a satellite, it will be ground observations, and it will cover a bit higher energies than Fermi's satellite did. So then we ask this question, like, given the sky that we saw with Fermi, what it is that we will, you know, how can we the best use this new experiment to, you know, find similar, you know, similar sort of things that we saw with Fermi, but also what new things we can, you know, test, maybe some things that were not clear with Fermi data, but will CTA be able to tell us, you know, to resolve some of the ongoing puzzles.
Where will be the CTA located and when it will start operating?
So CTA will be located in two locations. One in the north will be in Canary Islands, in La Palma, and one in the south will be in Chile, and so in Isosite. And so, I mean, because it's not satellite, it can go around Earth, but having two locations basically allows you to see the whole sky. So the first telescope is in La Palma already. And now the CTA is in a sort of, I think they call it entering construction phase. So it's happening, but yeah, the deployment of telescopes is not yet, you know, there will be a couple of more coming to La Palma and then the rest. It should be around 70 telescopes altogether, which is a lot, a huge number. So it's really a big array, exactly, of three kinds of telescopes.
So you are planning to go to the Canary Island and or to La Palma and then...
right. So I'm more theoretician as always, the data analysis part, so I'm not really necessary to be there physically, but yeah, definitely there will be, you know, I would love to go and to see those sites. And then just another thing that I'm also a little bit also very curious, in this, how can we use maybe machine learning and new analysis techniques on all this data to learn more from gamma rays, say. So this is something also I've been quite curious about lately. How can we maybe detect faint sources and things like that? So this is still, I would say, at least in my work, in exploratory phase. Like, we're still trying to figure out what are the good questions, like what are the questions that we could not maybe answer so far that maybe could be answered with these new techniques. So yeah, this is also something that hopefully, yeah, we can talk in the future about.
Yes, sure. So Gabriela, thank you very much for your time. I think that also our listeners will be happy with all the information, really interesting things that you spoke about. So thanks again for your time, and hope to see you soon on the podcast again.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
V tokratni epizodi bova zaradi prekomernega zavijanja daril med prazniki kar preskočili rubriko o novicah iz vesolja. Se bova potrudili naslednjič v naslednji epizodi in se omejili samo na dogajanje na nočnem nebu. V januarja letos bosta namreč možni dve taki bolj slikoviti opazovanji. Eno bo 13. in 14. januarja. Takrat boste lahko uro in pol po tem, ko bo sonce že zašlo, si ogledali mlad lunin srp, ki bo potoval v bližini Saturna. Za Saturn seveda lahko vidite s prostimi očmi, vendar če vas zanima pogled v Saturnove prstane, pa v tem primeru ti niso seveda vidni s prostim očesom, ampak se je potrebno poslužiti manjšega teleskopa, tako da boste lahko
pač videli Saturn, med drugim so to zdaj, je to zdaj še zadnje obdobje, v katerem bo Saturn tako dobro, dobro viden. Potem imamo pa naslednji dogodek, ki je pa nastopi 18. januarja in takrat bo Jupiter viden popoldne in zvečer v bližini Lune. Torej popoldne v smislu, da bo viden že čez dan, ti dve telesi Luna in Jupiter bosta samo 2,5 stopinje razdalje na nebu, na videz ne pač razdalje na nebu in pač čez dan bo sicer težje videti Jupiter, ker pač je nebo toliko svetlejše, ampak drugače pa bo možno pač videti Jupiter potem tudi kasneje, ko bo sonce zašlo in v bližini Lune. Gledali pa boste proti vzhodu, jugovzhodu, nekje mislim, da 30 stopin visoko nad tem jugovzhodnim obzorjem bosta videti oba dva. Tako nekako sta ti dve, mogoče dve opazovanji, ki lahko opravite sedaj januarja letos. Drugače bova pa v zapiske dodali tako prelete mednarodne vesoljske postaje, kot tudi drugih satelitov na nebu, ki jih lahko spremljate. Drugače pa naj omeniva, da je veliko teh opazovalnih izkušenj možno opraviti s pomočjo knjige Glej zvezde, ki jo lahko naročite na spletni strani astronomske revije Spika.
Prvo januarsko oddajo na praznični dan zaključujeva z lepimi željami v novem letu. Glasbeno kuliso podcasta je ustvaril Peli. Prisluhnite mu v podcastu Upravičujemo se za vse nevšečnosti, kjer z Alijem in Zijem razpravljajo o življenju, vesolju in sploh vsem.
In kdor želi, lahko z nama stopi v stik preko maila in sicer podcast.temnastranlune@gmail.com ali pa nama piše na družbenih omrežjih, kjer naj jo najdete z imenom Temna stran Lune.
Z vami so bili Dunja in Maruša, ki vam želiva v novem letu obilo jasnih noči.
Srečno!